I want to do one more saying before opening up to more questions. And this was the one that I think was most important to me. Well, maybe two more. Saying 13. Jesus asked his disciples, make a comparison, what am I like? Now we find this in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. You know, who do people say that I am? And in this text, Simon Peter said, you're like a righteous messenger. Matthew said, you're like an intelligent lover of wisdom. And Thomas said, teacher, I cannot possibly say what you are like. And Jesus said to Thomas, I'm not your teacher. You have drunk from and become intoxicated from the bubbling water that I poured out. Now, right, that's how I felt. This is an extraordinary saying. Again, it demonstrates to me what I would call an adult kind of spirituality. One of my colleagues at Lake Forest College in the sociology department, she said to me one day, she said, Ron, I just taught my best class. And I said, what happened? And she said, well, I'm doing this seminar group on Max Weber. And she said, I had a phone call right before class, and I came into class about 7 minutes late, and the students were sitting around the seminar table, you know, excitedly discussing the reading. And she said, I just stood at the door. I never even sat down. She said, that was my best class. Because the purpose of a good teacher is to disappear, to be surpassed by your students. And Jesus says to Thomas, stop calling me teacher. You've got this life in you. Speak out of your own experience. To me, it's like the Zen teacher who would kind of smack you in the head and say, grow up. See, and the kind of church that I grew up in, it seemed to me, always kept people infants. So, you know, you could be an 80-year-old couple who'd been going to church for 80 years, taking a trip in Siberia, and you go to see this young 28-year-old priest and say, Father, you know, we're going to be in Siberia. We're going to be 2,000 miles from a church. Can we have permission to miss Mass on Sunday? You know, and the priest will, yes, my children, you know. Instead, he should smack him in the side of the head and say, what's the matter with you? Can't you figure that out yourself? But a lot of churches don't do that. They never tell us to grow up. They never tell us to grow up. They seem to enjoy keeping people as children. And yet Jesus here is telling people to grow up. Now, someone's carrying a copy of Elaine Pagel's Beyond Belief. And one of the things that she says in there is, she believes that the Gospel of John in the New Testament was written precisely to challenge Thomas. Because you see, in Thomas, we're all words of God spoken into the world. Thomas means twin. In the beginning of the Gospel, speaks of Thomas Didymus. Didymus is the Greek word for twin. Thomas is the Aramaic word for twin. We're called, in a sense, to be Jesus' twin. Jesus is a reminder of who we are. In this sense of understanding Jesus, he's not different from us in kind, but different from us in degree. See, for most Christians, Jesus is a different kind of being, second person of the Trinity, come to earth, and so on. But here, he's what we are, but more spiritually evolved than most of us are. So we all have the capacity to be who he is. Just as in Buddhism, everyone has the capacity to be the Buddha, to be someone who wakes up. We all have that bodhicitta. We all have that power of enlightenment within us. Each one of us is kind of like a thermometer, and the mercury is at a certain level. For some, it's not very high. For some, it's high. For the Buddha, it was high. So he is the Buddha, the one who woke up. But he's not the Buddha instead of us. He's just a reminder of the Buddha in us. And so you have that strange saying in Buddhism, if you meet the Buddha on your path, kill him. Because you see, if we think that waking upness is over there in that person, we're never going to recognize that it's in ourselves. So at some point, we have to kill the Buddha. And that's exactly what Jesus is saying here. He's telling Thomas, get over this teacher bit. Lose me as teacher, Thomas. Start drawing on what you know, what you experience, what's within you. I'm not going to hang around here to be your teacher forever. See? This was astounding to me. I don't know anything like this in the canonical writings. The closest would be a verse in John's gospel where Jesus says that greater things than I have done you will do. And I always say, you can go to church for a long time and you probably won't hear many sermons on that verse. But this is an astonishing teaching. Don't call me teacher. Now, there's one more teaching I want to take before we open things up. And this, too, was one that, you know, when I first read this thing, I was like, what's going on here, you know? His disciples questioned him, should we fast? In what way should we pray? Should we give to charity? From which food should we abstain? Now, these are basic religious practices. Fasting, praying, almsgiving. Abstaining from foods. Jesus said, do not lie. If there's something you hate, don't do it. But wait a minute. What kind of teaching is this? And as I reflected on it, it seems to me, this is a problem endemic to organized religion. We have a set pattern. And we know what others are supposed to be doing. And so we can judge others if they're not doing it. Oh, hello. I didn't notice you here last Sunday. See, this is what leads to that kind of stuff in religion. Isn't this Ramadan? Why are you eating lunch? And so Jesus says, if you hate something, don't do it and don't lie. I mean, I don't think he means that giving alms or fasting or praying are bad things. He just means be careful. Be careful of this and be careful of organized religion because these things can become traps. And all of a sudden you're doing something because you're supposed to be doing it. You're doing something because it's expected of you by the group. You're doing something because, you know, it's part of the way we're defining ourselves. Now, the monastery that I'm going to tomorrow, the last abbot, Father Kelly, introduced something, you know, I think that was very, very useful. And the current abbot, who had been a cab driver in Chicago, by the way, he's quite an interesting abbot. The last abbot, though, introduced something very interesting. He said, even though there are 70 monks there, he said, I work out a pattern of spiritual practice for each monk that's individual. So now, like, they chant the Psalms 7 times a day, beginning at 2:30 in the morning. But the abbot may work out a pattern of prayer with a particular monk and say, you know, you go ahead and sleep through that one. And another monk said to me, well, I like to do some Buddhist meditation, so the abbot said I could do that instead of this. Now, what does that mean? It means that I can't judge another monk. I can't say, where were you at the 2:30 chanting? Because I don't know what his practice is. I think this is an important step. I mean, it's an important step for two reasons. It recognizes that each monk is an individual. But it's an important step because it gets out of the community life that potential to judge each other. And I think that's what Jesus was addressing here. And I think this is another form of maturity. I heard Rabbi Neil Gilman speak in Chicago, conservative rabbi, capital C, conservative movement in Judaism, and he made the statement, he said, to be a Jew is to have a covenant with God, but it could be that no two Jews have the same covenant. So I think that's healthy. It gets us away from that lockstep kind of religiosity. Because the lockstep religiosity is wrong in two ways. It's wrong because it might be inhibiting the growth of the particular individual. And it's doubly wrong because it gives another person the chance to judge you. And that gets religion into some very dangerous waters, I think. And that's why I think there's a teaching of Jesus, do not judge. Do not judge. So this and other teachings in here all sort of illumined for me a picture of an adult kind of Christianity that I didn't see too much of in my long lifetime experience with various Christian communities. Now, obviously, there are exceptions, but for the most part, it seemed to me, I saw a lot of infantile Christianity. I saw a lot of sincere Christians who were never given permission to grow up. I'll just close this part with one story. A woman I knew when I was teaching in Denver, she was in her 60s, and she said to me one day, she said, "You know, Ron, I'm not a good Catholic anymore." And I said, "Why is that, Mary?" And she says, "Well, you know, when we were in school, we had this little book of prayers that we were supposed to say every day." And she says, "You know, sometimes I start to say these prayers, and all of a sudden I just find myself kind of talking to God, and I don't finish the prayers." And I said, "Mary," I said, first of all, I felt angry that this woman went to church almost every day of her life, and nobody ever told her what I had to tell her. I said, "Mary, reading the prayers was just priming the pump." I think I can say that to this group. I said it in a college class recently, and this one student said, "What are you talking about?" I mean, not only had he never seen a pump, but he sure didn't know what it would be to prime it, you know? So I know I'm getting old. I have to stop talking about Fred Astaire and, you know, things like that. And I need to find, I'll ask Austin on the way home, I need a computer analogy to priming a pump, okay? There must be some computer analogy. But at any rate, most of you are old enough to understand priming a pump. And I said, "Mary, that's just priming the pump." I said, "You're not being a bad Catholic." I said, "You're just growing up in prayer." But I was really angry that no one's told her that, and that she feels bad about it, instead of celebrating it. So, you know, this has been what's excited me about Thomas. And as I said, you read the Gospel of John, and you all of a sudden you see it in a different way. See, it's in the Gospel of John that we learn about the doubting Thomas. The Thomas who isn't there when Jesus gives the gift of the Holy Spirit. And in John's Gospel, God's Word is made flesh only in Jesus. And one can become a son and daughter of God only by believing what God has done in Jesus. Whereas in Thomas's Gospel, God's Word is indeed fleshed in Jesus. But it's also fleshed in every one of us. And eventually, you know, we need to live lives as adults. Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan wrote a wonderful book about the last week of Jesus' life. And the whole theme of that is what Jesus did substitutionary or an invitation to participation? In other words, as a Christian, does one think of Jesus did something instead of me, or what Jesus did invites me, shows me how to deal with the difficult side of life, how to deal with the sacrificial element that's present in all love, how to deal with the suffering? Do you see that difference? You see, one to me is sort of childish. It's like the Deus Ex Machina in the old plays, you know, when the God came down in the elevator and fixed everything. It's believing in the God who does things instead of you. Some college students have signs they put up in the shared bathroom areas that says, "Your mother doesn't live here." See? So there's one view of God that God fixes things. He does things instead of us. But Borg and Crossan are saying a deeper reading of the gospel is it's an invitation for us to participate in the kind of life that Jesus lived, because he shows us how to deal with these difficult things of life. He doesn't do them instead of us, but he shows us how to do it. That's quite a different reading. So all of this stuff is kind of coming together for me, and I've been doing other workshops called, you know, well, I'm calling this one, What Will Christianity Look Like in 50 Years? I picked that because I'll be dead and nobody can prove me wrong. I was going to say in 10 years, but there's a chance I might still be around. But 50 years, I'm going to be off the stage, so there's no problem. I can't be proved wrong. So, you know, what will Christianity, and I kind of think there may be some Thomas communities around. I don't know exactly what they're going to look like. But there may be little pockets of mature Christians who see Jesus as a reminder more than as a redeemer, and who feel that they have the authority in themselves to act out of God's Spirit in their lives. They're not going to be big in numbers. The nostalgia churches will always be there. We'll always have the mega churches for people who want a safe and childhood world. That's okay. That's okay. We all grow at different stages in different ways. And so, you know, we'll still have churches where you can be a child and not have to take on adult responsibility. But I think there, on the other end of the spectrum, there will be a growing number of communities that will be committed to an adult living of the Christian life. That may be something quite different. And something parallel may be going on in Judaism and Islam and other traditions as well. All right, let me stop there, because this is a great group, and the best part will be to sort of interact with your questions and comments.
And I just want to say that since we are webcasting tonight, please just raise your hand. I'll come over here, and you can use the mic so that we can get the question heard around the world. So just let me know. I do have one question while you're thinking of something. I have one from someone who's listening to the webcast. It's actually sort of three questions about one verse.
Okay.
In the verse, if you bring forth what is within you will save you. And if you do not bring forth what is within you will destroy you. What is it that is brought forth? How does it redeem us if it is brought forth? And how specifically does it destroy us if not brought forth?
Okay, very good question. A very challenging verse. But I think you can see that verse is consonant with what we're talking about. It's within you. Our spiritual journey, our spiritual path, our spiritual evolution, our spiritual growth is about developing what is within us. As Jesus says to Thomas in that verse, you have that bubbling spring within you. Okay? So the only authentic spirituality is bringing forth what is within us. And that bringing forth is the higher consciousness and the higher conscience. The kingdom that is within us and the kingdom that is outside of us. And as the community grows with that consciousness and conscience, Jesus is returning. You see, for me, there is no Jesus coming back on the clouds. I don't think anybody's gone anywhere in a cloud. I don't think anybody's coming back on a cloud. To me, how does Jesus return? When you or I open up to that deeper consciousness within us, which in Christian vocabulary is called the Christ consciousness, and you can open up to the Christ consciousness as a Buddhist or a Jew or a Muslim, you know, that's just a name for it. Paul says, put on the mind of Christ. That would be view the world with that consciousness. If we produce that, then Jesus has returned. And when humankind reaches a stage where that is sort of normative consciousness and normative conscience, this is the prophecy in Jeremiah 31:31, there'll come a time when no one will have to teach his neighbor about God because everyone will have that awareness of God. It's the prophecy of Isaiah. There'll come a time when men will not learn war anymore, when we'll realize that war is not a very evolved way of conflict resolution. You know, there is an evolution of consciousness going on, despite all the bad news in the world, since most of the world is still run by people with tribal consciousness. But there is an evolution of consciousness going on despite that. That's the return of Jesus, not somebody coming on a cloud. So, we need to produce that which is in us. That's consciousness and that's conscience. If we don't bring that forth, see, then even what is within us will be destroyed. There's a parable in Thomas that's not in the other Gospels about a woman walking home with a jar of grain. And these jars were carried upside down and they had little spigots on them. And this spigot had joggled loose and she didn't notice. But the grain was leaking out on the path, and when she got home, the jar was empty. See, if we don't bring forth what is within us, it'll just finally trickle out on the path. And then it'll finally destroy us in the sense that that growth in us will be destroyed. It can't happen because we've lost that on the path. So that would be the way I would understand that verse. Did I hit all the points in those three questions?
I think so.
Okay.
You've left people speechless here. I want to say that I really enjoyed your analogy, because it's so simple, of the house of consciousness, you know, of the basement, first floor, second floor, and sun deck.
Right.
But the whole thing about do not judge, using the childishness, seems to me that there's implicit in that a judgment in terms of development. You know, one is childish.
I think that's a good point. When Jesus says not to judge, what is it we're not to judge? Obviously, there are things we do judge. I mean, I gave midterms today, and I'm going to take them and grade them, you know, and some people are going to get better grades than others. And if the traffic cop stops us on the way home, and I'm sure he won't because Austin is a careful driver and says we're speeding, he's going to judge us. So obviously there's a level where we do judge. I think we can judge external behavior. What I think we cannot judge is that interiority of the other person, how that person is before God. And people will always ask me, you know, what about Hitler? What about Jeffrey Dahmer? Yeah, I mean Hitler and Jeffrey Dahmer too. I don't know what's going on in those people. I can judge behavior, and certainly there are certain people who have to be institutionalized and we have to be protected from certain people. We can make judgments about behavior. And I can judge that certain kind of behavior, you know, like, let's say, the 80-year-old couple taking the trip to Siberia that want to know whether they can miss Mass, I can say that that behavior seems to indicate less of an evolved consciousness. Does it mean that I can say anything about those people as they stand before God? No. Can they be holy? Of course. Can they be sincere? Of course. Are they beloved of God? Of course. I can't make any judgment about them, but I can say that that kind of behavior seems less evolved. Just like the student in my class who will ask, will that be on the exam, is less evolved than the student who's there to really learn something. So I think there's a very important question. I'm glad it's asked. Can we judge certain things? Sure. Of course, we can judge behavior. We have to judge behavior in almost every level of life. But we cannot judge, even in a Hitler or in a Jeffrey Dahmer or in anybody, I can't judge what's going on inside of that person. I think no one has access to that but the divine reality.
I was going to ask if you'd enlighten me a little bit. This whole subject is very interesting to me, but I'm wondering what the Orthodox, let's say Catholic view of the Gospel of Thomas, what their attitude is toward it, or how they're treating it, or where they see it in the picture of their evolution.
For the most part, the question is, how are the organized religions reacting to these 30 Gospels that aren't in the canon? For the most part, they're being ignored or dismissed. One well-known scripture scholar, for whom I have a lot of admiration, made a statement that I was disappointed in. He said, they were garbage then, and they're garbage now. And one woman I know, she bought a copy of my Thomas book, and she gave it to a friend, and she said, you know, a couple days later, the friend gave it back and said, why would I read this? It's not in the New Testament. So, for the most part, the churches aren't doing anything with these Gospels. They're just kind of hoping they'll disappear. And if they do anything with them, it's to say, oh, these are very late and they're full of errors, and then label them Gnostic or something like that. Not that anybody knows what Gnostic means, but it's one of those little terms, you know, like if you call something socialist in this country, then it's bad. So in my field, if you call something Gnostic, it's like, oh, well, that's no good. So, oh, that's just a Gnostic gospel. Well, that's enough of that. Throw away Thomas. So that's the reaction.
I had a follow-up question on judgment. Thinking of the text, judge not lest ye be judged.
Right, that's what I was quoting.
Yeah. Well, maybe in simplicity, I think of that as judgment is okay, like you're saying. Just be prepared to be judged by others.
Yeah, that's right.
And so right. It's all okay. Be careful.
Right. So in other words, if you want to judge, go ahead, but don't be surprised if you're judged at that same level. But see, I'll tell you the way I've come to see things. I don't believe that many people get up in the morning to do bad and evil things. I think that most people are acting according to the way they see the world. Even those Klansmen yelling down in Alabama are acting according to the way they see the world. Now, maybe that just helps me to live better. But I don't think people are saying, I want to do something bad today. I think we act according to the level of our evolution of consciousness. Our conscience follows our consciousness. If we have a tribal consciousness, then we will act tribally. Not because we're bad, but because that's honestly the way we see the world. Does that make some sense to some of you? And that's why I don't think I can judge people, because they can be totally sincere in the way they're acting, but they're seeing the world a certain way. And if I see the world differently, it's not through anything being special about me. It has a lot to do with the family I had, with the teachers I had, with people who invited me to stretch out and live in a broader world. I mean, I was a tribal Catholic when I went in the seminary. I was worried about whether people who weren't Catholic could be saved. I felt I had the absolute truth. I don't think I was a bad teenager. It was just the way I looked at the world at that time. And a lot of circumstances in life began to change me. One of my students, for instance, she was from, you know, some little town in Iowa where everybody was Methodist or Baptist. And she was a freshman in my class and, you know, was a staunch fundamentalist. And her minister had told her that anybody who wasn't Christian went to hell, and she believed it. And she thought that my ideas were pretty crazy. And in her junior year, she went to our Greece Turkey program. And she came back, and I can still remember this, she came almost running into my office, and she said, "Ron, I was at this mosque in Istanbul, and all these Muslims were praying." And she said, and this was the exact word she used. It's funny, because Paul uses these words. She said, "It was like scales fell from my eyes, and I said to myself, these people can't be going to hell. They're praying to God. God must be hearing their prayers. If God is tricking them into thinking they have a religion and they don't, then maybe God's tricking the Christians too." But she said, "I really don't believe in a trickster God." You see what I mean? It's just that experience had invited her to understand the world differently, to interpret it differently. And that changed her forever. So if we're able to see certain things, it's not because we're better people. It's not because we're smarter or holier or anything else. It's just because that we've been blessed enough with circumstances in our life that have made it possible for us to come out of the basement and explore other parts of that house in which we live. But the people in the basement can be holy and sincere, you know, and totally wonderful people. But they're living within a more restricted interpretive grid through no fault of their own. So that's kind of how I've come to see it.
Thank you. If Jesus came to remind us of who we are, and once we reach that level of Christ consciousness, should we also expect an ascension?
An ascension. Sure. I mean, see, I think all these images of up, when I worked on Matthew's gospel, I was interested in these images of up. Like when you light a lamp, you don't extinguish it, you put it on a lampstand. Or a city on a hill can't be hidden. Or say this from the housetops. All those images of elevation to me are images of consciousness. In the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus goes up on a mountain to teach. Well, like Moses, yes. But also, there's something about going up on a mountain. When I was at Snowmass, Colorado, and we went to the Sunday liturgy, the monk who gave the sermon gave a wonderful sermon, and he said, "You know, there's something about being in a mountain." And he talked about all these sacred mountains of the world, mountains sacred to Native Americans, sacred to Hindus, sacred to Buddhists. And he said, "What is it about mountains?" He said, "When I saw this mountain, I knew this is where I wanted to live. This was the monastery I wanted to join and where I wanted to live." He said, "Because I think when you're in the mountains, it makes it easier to have a higher consciousness. It sort of makes it easier to open yourself up to a mountaintop view of the world. Because it's a natural kind of analogy." I don't think Jesus literally meant we should climb up on our roofs to talk, you know. But what does it mean to go up on your roof? I think it means to think about what we're saying sometimes and see if we can go up on the roof. I mean, see if we can get out of the basement. These kids in Hands of Peace, some of them started wearing signs that said, "Get out of the basement." You could wear a sign that says, "Get up on the roof." Meaning when I'm in a situation and I find myself thinking a certain way, talking a certain way, reacting a certain way, can I take a deep breath and say, "Can I get up on the roof here?" So that's, and I think things like ascension are images of that sort. Going up in the clouds. I mean, I don't think anybody literally went up in clouds. First of all, in the world we live in, that doesn't make sense. You go up, you don't go up, you go out. And where would Jesus go in a cloud? I mean, but I had a discussion with a young minister. They're always such nice guys that come from Trinity, which Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, it's an evangelical college. And this young minister was like, what don't you understand? A cloud is a cloud. And I said, do you mean a cloud is like a helicopter? He said, yes. Yes. Jesus went up on a cloud and he'll come back in a cloud. And I said, well, you know, you and I have a differing view here. I said, I don't think Jesus went anywhere in a cloud. I don't think he's coming anywhere in a cloud. I said, I think these are images of transcendence, images of elevation. Different interpretations. Different understandings.
I wanted to say thank you for your analogy about bringing Christianity 100 and bringing it up to 300. I noticed that, like, with religion, it's based on culture and what we're taught to believe, and it's not really a relationship that we build with God by ourselves. It's like, you know, pretty much what you're taught. And then when you go and you experience and you learn and you visit other cultures, you're able to raise above that and say, hey, there's a whole lot more. So it's based on your experience.
Right.
And so I just really wanted to say I appreciate that.
Thank you. And again, you know, I just want to just stress that fact earlier that, you know, in some churches, some more liberal communities, I find this tendency to kind of bash fundamentalists. And I think that's very contrary to the teachings of Jesus. I mean, in New Orleans, some very fundamentalist churches opened their doors and their hearts and their lives to some of the people who were homeless. And I always want to make it clear when I'm talking about levels of consciousness, I'm not talking about levels of holiness. And I'm not talking about things that make anybody better than anybody else. I'm talking about ways of interpreting the world. And as I say, if we've been invited to interpret a world a different way, a way that feels bigger to us, that's, you know, something for which we can be grateful. But it's not something to take pride in, and it's certainly not something on the basis of which to judge someone else. It doesn't make us better. It just gives us a different way, a different space for understanding reality.
You talk about in the future there being Thomas congregations or communities. For a person who wants to practice an adult spirituality now, do you think it's possible to fit into any type of denominations, Christian denominations that are presently operating in America?
That's a question I'm asked a lot. You know, where do I go? I think there are places. I don't know Wheaton, but, you know, around where I live, Bob Thompson, who's a Baptist minister down in Evanston, has the Lake Street Church. And I go down there when I have a chance. He's worked with the Parliament of World Religions. He's studied with a Hindu teacher. His services, I think, are just infused with a real interreligious sense and a deep spiritual sense. And when I went down there recently, I saw 8 people that I had recommended that church to, who are very happy there. So I think there are communities, but you have to know, you know, sort of where you live, where you are, and where those communities exist. And it may be you have to start one. I printed out a little material I use in one of my presentations about Christianity's future, sort of a mock-up of how a Thomas community might meet, how the meeting might go, how it might be done. So I think there are pockets of this. I think there are places where it's happening. And either there's some place around you that you can find, or it might be, I think as Jesus would say to Thomas, do it.
I sort of enjoy a responsibility of trying to raise my consciousness. Should people also take responsibility for helping others? Is it a responsibility or just do it whenever you think?
It's a very tricky question, you know. People will say, well, you know, I've got this fundamentalist neighbor, or my cousin is fundamentalist. You know, what can I do? How can I change them? And I'm not quite sure that's the way to go. You know, the Buddhists have this notion, don't try to do another's practice. I think it's very important that we do our own practice. If our practice is authentic, I think it will be an invitation to others. And those who are ready will find it attractive. But I think it's very important, again, not to kind of try to push people in their own growth. I was telling Austin on the way down that I had a student years ago who was the head of our evangelical student group, and he took one of my New Testament classes and was in radical disagreement with the way I was teaching it. And I told him, I said, Craig, I said, you know, why don't you every other class or so take 5 or 10 minutes and present your view? And he did. He'd get up and he'd give his view. And then about 10 years after he graduated, I was dean of students then, and the secretary said, there, you know, somebody here to see you, and in walks this student. And he said, you know, he said, Ron, I'm an Episcopalian now, and I'm working for Bread for the World. And he said, I just want to thank you because, you know, if you had sort of put me down or demeaned me in any way, I think I would have hardened into what I believed. He said, but, you know, you were inviting, you let me talk to the class, you let me express my views. And he said, all of that stuff stayed in my mind. And he said, you know, after 5 or 6 years, it began to grow in me. And you know, I now am a part of the Episcopal Church. You know, I have a whole different sense of being Christian. So I think it's something we have to be very careful with, changing others, you know? Again, as I say, I think a mark of spiritual maturity is having nothing to prove and nothing to defend. You know, why do young people like the Dalai Lama? You know, he was elected by college students as most important person in the world. But I've been with the Dalai Lama on numerous occasions. He never is pushing anything down anybody's throat. He embodies it. If you ask him, he can state it, he can express it, and that's it. And if something is there that interests you, you can follow up. But he never, you know, induces shame or guilt or a sense of, you know, when are you going to get with it? Why don't you get out of that ridiculous religion you're in? When are you going to grow up? You know, none of that kind of language in him. Just real compassionate presence with others. So I don't know. I think it's a very important question. I think the best thing we can do is do our own practice and just be there for others as who we are.
Thank you, Ron. I'm wondering what this leads in your question about responsibility and helping others. Is there a Thomas saying about, and a child shall lead them? Because things you've said this evening remind me of the Indigo Children movement.
Yeah.
And since September 11th and Katrina, we read all the time about these kids who,
right,
in their lemonade stands, and they end up, you know, raising, you know, thousands of dollars and helping a lot of people.
Right.
They've got nothing to prove and nothing to defend.
Well, there is a saying I like. It's saying 37. His disciples asked Jesus, when will you appear to us? When will we see you? And he said, when you strip naked without shame and trample your clothing underfoot as little children do, then you'll look at the Son of the Living One without being afraid. And you see, I sometimes speak of Jesus' consciousness as Eden consciousness. It sort of takes us back symbolically to Adam and Eve before the act of disobedience. And they were naked, and they weren't ashamed. So it seems to me Jesus is saying, to know the reign of God and to know who I am, you have to live at that, with that Eden consciousness. That you can be naked again without shame. So in other words, you can overcome that sense of the world in which we make objects out of each other through stealing, through sexual assault, you know what I mean? All those ways in which we objectify the other. If we can be naked without shame and trample our clothes underfoot, you know, meaning not place any value on the things that worldliness gives so much value to, then we'll see who Jesus really is. Does that make sense? You know, in the teaching of Jesus, your treasure will always be where your heart is. So don't have your treasure, and I always ask students this, you know, don't have your treasure where moth consumes or rust destroys or thieves can steal. And I say, okay, let's knock out the moths. You know, there goes the cashmere sweater. Now we knock out the rust. There goes the Porsche in the driveway. Now you knock out what thieves can steal. That's everything else. What do you have left? You know? What's in here? Your heart will always be where your treasure is. So these people can take their clothes off, trample on them. In other words, they can go back to that garden that we've been barred from. They can go back to that garden, to that Eden consciousness. And that's where they're going to meet Jesus, because that's the consciousness out of which he lives. That's the way I would understand that. I think that runs through the teachings of Jesus. Like, don't take oaths. See, if you tell me something, I say, well, you ready to swear in the Bible that that's true? See, I'm presuming that you're lying to me, and I have to find ways to limit those lies. And Jesus says, let your yes be yes, let your no be no. Can we reach that place where anyone who knows you will say, well, Sally said this, and someone says, well, do you know if it's true? And you say, yeah. If Sally said it, then she meant it. Well, did she swear in a Bible? No, she doesn't have to. If she said it, it's true. Because when she says yes, it's yes. And when she says no, it's no. See what I mean? Jesus is always, I think, inviting us to reach that level of consciousness that is expressed in symbols like being naked, not having clothes, not being ashamed. That state of purity, that state of garden purity, which I think represents that unity consciousness, where we don't have enemies. We don't divide the world into friend and enemy. See, everything about lower consciousness has to do with dualities and divisions. And so this is really a call to live beyond duality and division, when the division falls away between friend and enemy. It's very, very challenging. It's very challenging. And we don't fight our way there. People often say, well, how do we grow in consciousness? I don't know. It seems to me, it's like taking a deep breath. You know, let's say we find ourselves expressing something at a very tribal level, or thinking something at a very tribal level. And then you just kind of take a deep breath and say, you know. And then you try to rethink it at a rational level. Well, that's a different viewpoint than mine. Okay. Then you take another deep breath and try to rethink it at a psychic level. Well, how does that person feel? What does it feel like to be that person? What's that coming from? And then maybe take another deep breath. You know, is that person really that different from me? Is there a way in which we're one? So I mean, I think we can actually practice that as an exercise. See, again, I think the most important thing I'd want to leave you with tonight is that we live in the world as we interpret it. I read an article in a Buddhist journal about driving. It says, you know, why do you drive? I ask my students, why do you drive? You know, to get where you're going. And this Buddhist article said, well, what if you think it another way? What if you're on the road to protect the lives of all sentient beings? That means that crazy driver, the deer that just ran into the road. So now you're cut off, but instead of heating up with curses, your reaction is, how can I keep everybody safe? See, all we do is change the interpretation. And when we change the interpretation of what it is to drive, we potentially change the behavior. Change our mind. When we change our mind, we change our world. We change the world we're experiencing. And I think we can do that. I mean, it's something we can really practice. I think that's why the first of the Eightfold Path is right view. That's absolutely basic, a right view. Or again, the phrase that I like in Paul, put on the mind of Christ. Okay. What is it to have that Christ consciousness?
Using the examples that you've used this evening, referencing the Lord's Prayer when we say, on earth as it is in heaven, which kind of comes across, there's no duality. Earth and heaven is one. Do you also see in your examples where the lower or the basement is now absorbed into the root or the higher consciousness, and then we have super beings walking this earth?
Well, I mean, I think that is interesting. That next phrase is interesting, on earth as in heaven. Again, if heaven is a level of consciousness, then God does reign in heaven, and God's will is done in heaven. In other words, at that higher level, God reigns and God's will is done. So when we say on earth, I think we're precisely looking at that field of practice in which we want what is done on earth at our lower level of consciousness to be aligned with how life is experienced at that higher level of consciousness. So there's always that stretching of our earth to heaven. I think, again, it's part of that height imagery that I think runs through a lot of the teachings.
Well, I want to thank you for this evening.
Thank you.